Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm net control operator for the Limark Technical Net. It's been going strong for four odd years. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we sit in front of our radios and we share with each other. We learn from each other, we teach each other, and hopefully we entertain each other. And once again, I thank you for coming back here this Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do it all over again. Let me drop for a second and I'll give you the usual links. Okay, if you would like to reach me by email, that would either be for mailbag questions. Those are questions that usually are asked on the technical net. If you don't have access to the repeater, you can email them to me and we'll discuss them. And you can listen to them live on a internet stream or in the archives. Or if you have a topic that's in the news that you'd like to share with us, technical and scientific, or if you have a TechNet puzzle that you'd like to share with us, or that you'd like me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him his opinion of something NASA or space-related, you can email him directly. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. My email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Also, we have links available throughout the week. I cut interesting articles, YouTube, what have you. Put it on a link page. You can get to it anytime. Just type into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com, and that will give you the link page. We have a chat room available. It's been kind of quiet lately, but if you would like to gain access to it, you just type into your browser, chat.ac2gs.com. And, of course, I mentioned earlier, we have an Internet audio stream. If you type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, it'll give you the audio stream of the technical net, during the technical net, and the rest of the week, for the most part, you'll be able to listen in to whatever's going on the Glen Oaks repeater. I leave it live most of the time, other than maintenance and such. And as always, I like to remind people that MikeKC2NJI has a great archive site of the technical net that go back as far as September of 2006. Site is anderradio.tv, so please take a look at it. It's very, very interesting. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you what we got planned. Tonight will be a rather vanilla edition of the late Passover version of the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club's technical net. We will ask for questions of a technical nature. We can discuss topics, comments, what have you. I would like the first few to be of a amateur radio-related topic, but as the night progresses, you can open it up to anything science and technology-based. I'm more willing to discuss that as well. But since we are an amateur radio club and a net, we should start off with something amateur radio-related. That should take us to about 10:15. Paul, join us for the SpaceNet report, which will take us to about 11 p.m., I will return and tie a bow on it and wish you well for the week. So that's my plans. If the nature of the universe don't change, my shack doesn't malfunction, the repeater doesn't malfunction, or the world doesn't malfunction. Anyway, with that in mind, we're open for business. If anyone has any questions or things are kind of a technical net, please hit that push to talk. Give me your first name and your call sign.
W2LVQ, the name is Ron. Good evening.
W2BZ, ham radio related.
Ron and Rich,
Julia,
recognize
that. Ham related question.
Okay, very Charlie. I thought you were just going to be saying hello again.
Oh, wait till later. I'm going to talk Paul's ear off.
Okay, so we got Ron, we got Rich, and we got Charlie. Anyone else want to put their name down? Very well. Ron, what's your question or your comment for today?
Well, thanks. I'll say good evening to everybody on the net. It's always an interesting net. That's why I try to check in. There's so many things. Besides ham radio, there's so many interesting things out there. And I just happened to come across a video about Prince Rupert's drop. Have you ever heard that?
Yes, I have. They're very fascinating. I never owned one, But I have seen YouTube's galore of them being made. It's a fascinating consequence of the stress that are built into those glass objects. One end is impenetrable, and the other end, if you breathe on it too heavily, causes a cascade failure that fractures the entire unit. They're quite interesting. I've always kind of would have liked to have one, but I probably would have broken it long ago.
Roger. I'm sure that you've heard about everything because you were knowledgeable. Anyway, yeah, I thought it was fascinating. I just saw a video about a guy who was actually trying to break one in polymer so he could freeze the action. And he did it. Came out pretty darn good. It took him a lot of tries, but he's actually got a beautiful paperweight, clear polymer with Prince Rupert's drop disintegrating in it. Real cool. Anyway, that's it for me. I'm going to turn it back to you. This is W2LVQ.
Okay, very good. For those people who aren't addicted to YouTube, you should kind of Google Prince Rupert drop. What it amounts to is you can melt glass into a molten form, and then if you're very talented, you can drip it into a pail of water to cool it very quickly. What happens is it has the front end is a kind of a bulbous mass, and then it trails out to a thin tail from the pore, and the bulbous mass, you could bang on it and nothing much happens. There's a lot of internal stress in the glass structure, but it's most fragile at the tail. So if you just nick the tail, the entire object fractures in very small broken glass particles. What they did on the YouTube was they made some Prince Rupert drops. They immersed the bulb and part of the tail into epoxy, and then they broke the tail once the epoxy had hardened, and it fractured internally a transparent way to make a nice effect. So you have nothing better to do, go over to YouTube one of these days. Don't go tonight. And Google Prince Rupert drops. They're quite fascinating. Any other comments before we move on to the next person?
How do they make the glass melt?
The old-fashioned way, with any kind of acetylene torch, whatever it takes to just heat up a small amount of glass. It's not that difficult these days to make glass melt. There's a lot of ways to get higher temperature. And then you just use the proper implement so that they don't break from the thermal shock of it all. And you just drip it down. YouTube is full of people who are casting all kinds of metals and forming all kinds of things. You know, back a couple thousand years ago, it was very difficult to get things hot enough for things like iron to melt. But nowadays, you could buy acetylene torches, or you can buy furnaces that are relatively not that terribly expensive that can rise to the occasion.
Comment?
Yes.
Yeah. The what I saw was that they got these from a commercial from a glass blower who had the equipment, the furnace. He had a whole shop. He was making them for them. You can also buy them, I understand. So, I don't think it's something. It's not a do at home project. You know, maybe to do the polymer pot, but to actually make the drop, you need to have real glass blowing equipment, furnace, and all that good stuff.
Well, it depends what you can find on, on Amazon and what have you. You'd be surprised. There are guys out there on YouTube who are trying to reinvent the wheel, and one particular guy decided that one episode of his YouTube was going to be reinvent glass blowing, and he kind of made a primitive heat source and was able to melt glass. I mean, the easiest, the cleanest way is to just buy one. But theoretically, if you're motivated enough, it wouldn't put you into the poorhouse to be able to get the equipment to melt glass and then just kind of drip it into a pail of water. You know, I'm not saying it's easy. I'm just not saying it's not quite impossible. Okay, I guess we've run through that. Rich, what's your question, comment for tonight?
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody else. My question has to do with the following. Take a 10-foot piece of wire, and you attach at one end, you attach a coil of 100 turns of copper anode wire, and from that, you attach another 10 feet of wire. So there's a coil right in the middle of two sections of 10 feet. Is there a way to calculate where that antenna would be resonant? That's the question.
Theoretically, yes. Practically, it's probably incredibly easier to just sweep it with a VNA. I mean, you can calculate what the inductance and the inductive reactance is if you know the all the specs of the coil. What's the diameter of the coil, the number of turns, what's the spacing between them, and then plug it into an approximate calculation for air core, you know, rather than having any kind of ferrite core or solid core, and get an approximate inductance and plug that in to antenna equations. But like I said, the much more accurate way is simply to pull it out in the backyard, plug it into a VNA, and see what it does. And then you can always spread out the coil if it requires that, or push them together if required, and, you know, tune it up to the proper frequency.
But I would want to know the resonant frequency before I cut anything. In other words, work it out on paper. Let's say I wanted a 10-meter, a long wire for 10 meters or just the 20 meters. I would like to know that before I cut it, so not after I cut it, and then measure it with a VNA.
Well, I mean, as far as I know, every time I've ever seen any kind of discussion for inductively loaded antenna, which is what you're talking about, it's always been a kind of a recipe type of a thing. Someone comes up with a random selection of X number diameter coil with a Y number of turns, and then they prune back the long wire to the appropriate resonance. I've never seen in any issue of QST or RADCOM, which is the Radio Society of Great Britain, where they actually calculate inductive reactances and then the ultimate resonant frequency. So, although I guess you can try and do that, the error inherent in that type of procedure probably is too wide to warrant the exercise. But if there's anyone out there who has ever had any experience, they actually sat down with the electronic circuits handbook and tried to calculate out and got it right the first time, please let me know.
Well, getting the inductance for the coil is easy. I have a meter that measures inductance. So that's easy to do. But measuring, it to me it seems like it would be something that would be, an ordinary calculation, because once you got calculation, you then cut the antenna to what you calculated out the range to be. So, why is it esoteric, Roy? Roy, are you there?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Well, like I said, I mean, the problem is that I have never heard of anyone actually doing it. So my guess is that there's something that isn't that obvious. As it is, the equation that everyone sort of knows, the 468 equation to measure the length of a proposed center-fed dipole, is not based on an equation, really. It's based on kind of reversing practical experience. The ARRL back in the 20s or 30s built a lot of center-fed dipoles, got them onto resonance, measured them, and then kind of backtracked with that calculation that, you know, the equation to discover the best length. So my guess is there's something a little bit more complicated about the equation than we both are aware of. Again, I have never once seen, you know, I used to read QEX, and if there was ever going to be equations written about calculating the optimal inductance for a loaded antenna, it would be in something like QEX, and I don't remember seeing it even there.
Yeah, then I guess on its face, though, right? If you think about it, 10 feet of wire, a coil, where you know the inductance, and another 10 feet of wire equals what resonant frequency, doesn't seem on the face of it that hard, you know? But you're right. You know, I haven't seen any formulas to calculate the resonant frequency for something like that.
Comment?
Yes, please.
KC2, SHO here. You know, we used to hear Dick comment about the Brown and Woodward curves often. Would that be useful in this scenario, Roy? KC2, SHO, Connect Control.
Unfortunately, no. Those curves didn't have anything to do with loading coils. They much had to do with frequencies and length and how they relate. And they also, in much the same way as the ARRL, they were not based on an equation. Later on, people tried to fit an equation to those curves, but they were kind of backwards. It wasn't based on any fundamental equation. It was simply based on experimental facts. And the curves that Dick used to mention frequently were all based on experimental results. They put up a lot of antennas. They measured them, and they plotted them on that graph.
IWN. Thank you for the clarification. That's really all I had at the moment, but hopefully I'll talk more soon. ECTGFKC2SHO, thank you.
Okay, very good, John. Always glad to have you aboard. Paul, you wanted to say something?
Being in the ballpark, let's say, you know, Rich has got 10 foot and 10 foot, so it's 20 feet. Say the coil, just for last, takes up, you know, another 10 feet. You know, you're going to wind this coil. You know, it's a length of 20, you know, of 30 feet now. You know, use the 468, you know, formula and, you know, just, you know, convert it to 50. Wouldn't that at least get you into the ballpark? And then hopefully you have an antenna tuner to fix fix any mistake. I think that would get you close.
Well, it might get a little close, or not very close, because the problem is that it isn't the inherent length of wire in the coil that lowers the resonant frequency identical to a straight piece of wire. If you take the same piece of wire and you coil it up as an inductor, it has a much greater effect in lowering the frequency of the resonant frequency of the antenna. So I mean, you'll know what direction you're going in, and you'll have a vague sense of the magnitude, but you could easily be off by 400 or 500%, depending upon how closely the coils are made together. Because, you know, not all inductors are equal. It depends, as I said, on the diameter of the wire, on whether it's coated or not with a dielectric material, what the diameter of the spirals are, and what the distance between each coil of the total coil is. So it'll give you a direction. It just probably won't get you very close to the final answer.
Okay, understood. You know, I just look at it as 30 feet. Let's say it was 30 feet long. You know, you'd have one particular frequency. Now you start to coil it up little by little, you know. And as you're going along, frequency is going to change. But drastically... Okay, understood. Back to you, Ross.
Yeah, it's not only a matter of the length, but the problem with mistuned antennas is they're either have a residual capacitive reactance or inductive reactance. In the case of shortened antennas, they have a capacitive reactance. So you have to oppose it with an equal amount of inductive reactance in order to remove the reactant part of the impedance and have it be purely a radiation resistance. That's usually when things are when both the inductive and capacitive reactances cancel each other out and you're left only with real resistance. And although it makes inductive sense that, you know, inductors are just loops of wire that they add length to the antenna in a compact way. They do it in a complex form, in the same sort of anti-way that capacitors have the exact opposite effect and don't look or anything like length wire being short. But I could see where you would think that. And again, it gives you the idea of where you're going, but it doesn't. You're still going to need kind of a VNA or something to test the grid dip meter or something to tell when you're resonant or not.
Okay, I get that from Dick from years ago. You know, run a 160 meter antenna. Just go left, right. Doesn't matter. You know, you have a small piece of property. Well, each time you make a bend or a curve, or you know, you're adding inductance. So, you know, let's say you make a three-inch diameter coil in the middle of this thing, you know. Just because they're closer together, that's going to change it. Very good question, though. Back to you.
Yeah, as always, she comes up with an interesting question. Ultimately, antennas are both inductors and capacitors. That's the whole reason why they have a resonance. And so the length of wire, even though it's not coiled, has an inherent inductance to it. In the same way that you can think of transmission lines as lumped circuits, combinations of capacitors and inductors across entire transmission length. So, and this becomes a big pain in the backside when you're dealing with microwaves. And the leads of capacitors act as inductors, and inductors can have capacitance, and things get very, very complicated on the PC board.
Hey, Joe.
Yes, John.
You know, Rui, so what's going on, let's say, like, the top element of a Alpha Delta DXCC dealer getting two bands with no... no real trap. There's no capacitor or anything there. It's just a coil of wire between the extension for the higher band and the primary wire for the lower band, lower frequency band. So what's actually happening there?
What's happening is you're offering your transmission line a number of parallel band dipoles. The one that's resonant is close to 50 ohms of impedance. So your transmission line will pour most of its energy out the element, the appropriate element that's approximately 50 ohms of impedance at that frequency. If you change frequencies, the condition changes and a different element will present itself to your transmission line as a 50 ohm load and most of the current will be drawn to the appropriate resonant fan dipole.
Yeah, understood, similar to the way a locked periodic works, but I'm talking solely about the top element that has the loading coils out towards the end. Let's take my DXCC, for example, that has 40 meters and 80 meters on the top element only. What? Forget about the rest of the dipole. What's just happening on a dipole that has two bands without any of the other fan dipole? Follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, that I had the same exact fan dipole, and that seemed the most strange, magical, problematic antenna element, because they made a point of telling everyone that it wasn't a trap, which it isn't, because there's no capacitor. In order for it to act as a trap, you would have to have a capacitor in addition to a loading coil. So my only assumption of what's going on is at the lowest frequency, the coil is not representing a large enough reactance to put the current and is adding to the additional inductance, making it more resonant at 80. On 40 meters at that frequency, the inductance of the loading coil is somewhat retarding current past that point. Although it's not a true trap, it's kind of a marginal semi-trap, if you will. And that was my best guess of why that should work.
KD2, FIU?
Yes, George.
Well, what's happening with the DXDD, single element, and MFJ made one, Diamond makes one. They're all approximately 80 to 85 feet long, I believe. And they're a result of an antenna experimented by W4JRW, Bill Latin, in the 1950s. The concept he worked with is an approximately 120 microhenry loading coil at a specific experimental distance from the feed point of the dipole, and then extending a length after that, brought you to anywhere between an effective dipole antenna that was somewhere between 125 to 135 feet long. So you are neither building a 40 meter up to the inductor, you're not trapping it, you are in fact building a electrical 125 to 135 foot long dipole because of the inductor. And if you really can see this, when if you were to construct one with the 120 microhenry loading coils, and I'll get where Latin found these formulas. The loading coil is placed somewhere between 69 and 72 feet in length of the first dipole that you're wiring to the loading coil, which in effect is not a 40-meter antenna. It's resonating at about 13.4 to 13.6 megahertz. So you don't have a 40-meter antenna to the loading coil. You're electrically loading the tip another 4.5 to maybe 5.5, 6 feet of that. After the length of the loading coil and its effective inductance, you're making it somewhere between 125 to 135 feet long. But because of a loading coil, you're not going to get the bandwidth on the 3.5 to 4 megahertz that you want. Usually between 60 and 100 kilohertz, depending upon the length within 5 feet of the overall length and the inductive characteristics, or whether they're anywhere from 110 to 130, sometimes even 100 microhenry will do it. And Roy, let me drop, and can I come back?
Sure.
Actual formulas for developing these loading coils were developed in 1924. And they were written, the formulas and graphs written in the Bureau of Standards. All right, circular number 74, radio instruments and measurement manuals. They were signed in 1937 in the radio instrument and measurements manuals, volume 2. Different people, different companies, different ham radio operators, different discoverers have worked with these formulas. As of today, nobody has really placed them into any computer models. A lot of companies worked with this in the 1950s. A lot of individuals who were antenna designers worked with this in the 1950s and 60s, which helped come out with a lot of designs of antennas that we commonly know today. So as far as referencing back to where is the information available, it's an extremely old manual. It's the radio instruments and measurement manuals, circular white paper form 74, published in 1937, where it's going to give you the actual formulas and graphs on how to design the inductance measurements required to lengthen the wires. Those measurements were all really kind of like experimented with what types of materials. As Roy pointed out, the gauge of the wire, the spacing, the diameter of the coil, and things like that were basically experiments based on those formulas of how to design loading both for RF control over a single wire, developing different lengths of the wire. Back to you, Roy, KD2FIU.
Okay, thank you very much, George. I think that's what's going on, and I could be completely wrong, is that once again, as I mentioned earlier, those curves that Houston mentioned, were experimentally derived. After the fact, people tried to extrapolate an equation based on the experimental data, but it really didn't add anything to the mix, and I think these are somewhat similar. What people did for years and years and years was experiment, graph it, and present curves, but because it's dependent upon so many variables that can't be controlled, in industry, when you have a single supplier, you have much control. So you can take your supplies, do a lot of experimental tests, generate a series of graphs. You might even be able to backtrack and make up an equation that fits the most points for that. And so for the purposes of their companies, they have something to use. The reason why we don't have anything in the ARRL handbook is because there's no accurate generalized set of equations for that. They're more specific for the materials used by the individuals doing the test. Now, as far as I'm aware, the only two companies that are selling this type of antenna, and it's part usually of a fan dipole, is Alpha Delta. Makes a very nice one. And also E-Antenna, which I believe is a Spanish manufacturer of antennas. So those two guys make fan dipoles with one version that operates on 40 and 80.
KD2FIU.
You know, well, George, just
a couple of things here.
In a way,
the electromagnetic effects of low loading coils on a single element
with antenna modeling software.
Was actually discussed and plotted
of the
electrical principles,
and it'll come up with resonant
the RF signals.
So
in that Bureau of Standards,
if you use,
written twice, once in 1924 and once in 1937, these were engineering formulas
software
that were based on the electrical principles related to the electromagnetic effects. From there, then people played it. By the way, another thing, to go a little further, if you're interested in buying these, the MFJ... 17758 is one. DFED is one from Alpha Delta. Diamond 735 is one of them. And there's another company. Ultimax in Florida makes one also. He claims to make the most heavy duty one. But that's all I got, Roy. KD2FIU.
Okay, I was completely unaware of these fan dipoles. I've been investigating fan dipoles for many years. I haven't come across those from MFJ or the other manufacturers. All I know of is the EN and the Alpha Delta.
They are not fan dipoles. They are single element dipoles with loading coils near the end and an extended tail of wire to resonate the loading coil to a that the entire single dipole itself resonates at almost double the lower the frequency. And all of those companies do make that. I unfortunately made one, handmade round on the coils, 195 turns, about 11 inches long. I forgot the exact formulas to make 195 turn, 120 microhenry loading coils, and my antenna came out to 79.5 feet, which I trimmed. And you gotta trim. You can't say I'm going to trim 40 meters before the coils. You're not going to get it. You can't say I'm going to trim 75 or 80 meters at the coils. To trim yourself within the portion that you want to be on 75 or 80 meters, you're going to have to be adjusting the first dipole before the loading coils and then adjusting the second tails after loading, loading coils to make your full length of your antenna. You can't just make a 40 meter, then go through the inductor, and then add the tail to make a 75 or 80 meter. You're making four adjustments to bring you where you want to be. Fortunately, the length of it being somewhere between 125 and 135 feet electrically, although it's somewhere between 78 and 85 feet physically, that length brings you in on 40 rather quickly with a lot of bandwidth, at least 200 kilowatts. Kilohertz under 1.5 to 1, whereas you're going to get somewhere between 60 and 100 kilohertz on either 3.5 to 3.7 or 3.7 to 4, 3.8 to 4, like that. So you play with four adjustments to get this where you want it on both bands. KD2FIU.
Okay, I think me and John were more talking about the fan dipole designs that implemented that. That inductor in the middle of the 4080 element. It's part of a larger 10 to 80 fan dipole array that companies sell.
Well, the DXCC is also using a DXDD in it.
Yeah, but we were kind of talking about those two. John was talking about the Alpha Delta antenna, I believe. Anyway, I appreciate your information. I thank you for it. Most of us don't kind of look back at the 1920 books. Like I said, I think if there were 9 equations for these things, they would be available in the present literature. A lot of the work back in the 20s and the 30s was more experimental than theoretical. But thanks for adding that.
KD2FIU clear. You're welcome.
I doubled, let me see if I have it. It was W2B. I doubled with George for, what I was saying was, he came up the closest you can get to figuring this out, it would be with the antenna modeling software. Because you could put, different lengths of elements and put a coil of a certain inductance in the middle of it or towards the end of it or whatever and come up with a resonant frequency. So I guess they do it, and I'm pretty sure they do it in antenna modeling software. At least that's my understanding. Back to net.
Okay. Yeah, I guess theoretically you could get a ballpark figure if you model an antenna with an inductance. But again, the problem tends to be you're not going to buy a store-bought, you know, small inductor for your antenna. Most people will just build coils. And you can roughly, I guess, plug it into a VNA or something similar and get the inductive impedance reactance for it and plug it into the equation. You know, I wouldn't suggest people depend upon that. It'll give you a ballpark figure, but you're still going to need to kind of adjust, probably build the antenna a little bit longer than the antenna simulation suggests, and then be prepared to prune it back.
When I built my shortened, I built two of them, shortened N-fed half-waves. I wound my own coils. I bought a meter. I think they're called LCR meters that measure capacitance and inductance. So coming up with the perfect inductance was easy. I just wound it until I hit the, you know, the inductance I was looking for. But then I wound, then I made an antenna with two coils in it because I read some guy's design could get up to 80 meters. And even though I was hurt on 80 meters, you know, it was like S2 signal reports. So that didn't work out too well. So I went back to my one coil end to halfway, which just goes up to 40 meters. So that's my experience. Anyway, thanks everybody for answering or trying to answer my question. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Thank you as always for participating, Rich. Charlie, you're up next. What you got?
Okay, I'm making a go box. I would like a 50 watt AM radio in a suitcase and like to have it to run on a solar panel.
That's it? That's the question, Charlie?
Yes, I need to know to have it run at low or medium, what kind of solar panel am I going to need?
Well, I mean, it depends upon the radio equipment you're going to use. If you're planning to transmit 50 watts, chances are you're going to need at least something that's able to put out 130, 140 watts of electricity. So it depends upon the surface area and the light intensity. Most likely you're not going to just go with a solar panel and be damned. You're going to really need a battery to act as a storage medium. So your choices are either lithium, a lithium polymer, lithium ion, lithium iron phosphate is very, very popular. It's a little bit safer than the lithium ion and lithium polymer. Or you can go with the old standard lead acid batteries and use them to be charged up by the solar batteries. And depending upon how you configure it, you might want to build some kind of a circuit that transfers power from one to the other as it can. But that's probably what you're going to need. You're going to need significant solar panels. I don't exactly know what surface area you would need to build up and charge up something like 130 watts. The 130 watts is going to come from the lithium iron phosphate or the other rechargeable batteries. And then the problem is going to be, you know, how big a solar cell can you afford and want to carry around to charge back your battery as fast as possible.
I thought maybe a 50-watt solar panel would be more than enough on a 50-watt radio.
Well, it sort of depends upon what you mean by a 50-watt radio. Most times when people use that term, they mean a radio that is capable of transmitting 50 watts. Since no electrical piece of equipment is 100% efficient, you're definitely going to need a little, significantly more than 50 watts to run a 50 transmitter. if you in fact mean a radio transceiver that only uses 50 watts, yeah, I guess then you would just need something that puts out 50 watts. But again, the solar cell is going to fluctuate in power that it gives you depending upon if a cloud covered you or not. So you're going to need some kind of intermediate rechargeable battery between the two. The point of the solar battery is to recharge the battery. You're not going to be able to consistently get, unless you get a lot of solar cells, consistently get power to power your radio. You'll find that as the clouds pass by you, your radio will go kind of brown on you and such. So, it, again, depends on what you mean by 50 watts. If you mean 50 watts of transmission power, that doesn't mean that it makes 50 watts. That means that it puts out 50 watts, and they're usually about 30% efficiency. But you're still going to have some kind of intermediary power storage device. You can't rely directly from the solar cell to your equipment.
Okay, that answers my question. So I should have a battery on my radio and then the solar panel to charge my battery.
Yes, yes, that's the way most people work it.
Thank you very much. Now I feel like I feel happy.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that, Charlie. Anytime, you know where to find us. Once again, this is A2GS, and we have here the Limark Technical Net. We got a lot of free time, so if anyone has any questions or comments for tonight, feel free to hit that push to talk.
I don't know if you have me on a list.
No, Wesley. This is the first time I've heard you tonight.
Oh, I was registering myself.
I'm terribly sorry. Maybe you doubled with someone else, because I hear you.
Okay, so tell me what is my...
Okay, is it amateur radio related or non-amateur radio related?
No, it's not amateur radio related.
Okay, well, we'll see if there's someone out there with amateur-related questions, and we'll go from there. Yeah, this is AC2GS, Roy here with the Limark Technical Net. If there's anyone out there with any further amateur radio-related questions or comments or topics to discuss, hit that push to talk button.
November
2,
Zulu Charlie.
Yes, November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Yeah, good evening, Roy. Good evening, Ned. I came on a little late, probably got on about 8:20, so forgive me if it was discussed or if it was discussed in another forum. But I just became aware, and I want to know if anybody else did, with the notice from FJ that they're closing shop in May.
Oh, I haven't heard that yet. That's a shame. It's not incredibly surprising. The guy who runs it, I think, is in his late 70s these days. So, you know, perhaps he went looking for a buyer and right price. Did they definitely say that they're just kind of holding the business, or did they say that they were up for sale? John, are you out there?
Yeah, figure me right. I was going to read his notice to you, because it seems you didn't hear about it. But when I go on to another page, as you know, I'm using the echo link, the push to talk and everything. But in a nutshell, it sounds to me like he didn't find a buyer. It sounds to me he's just closing the doors. He gave a brief explanation saying that had a good run, but after COVID, things never recovered. It was the hardest hit the company ever, never recovered. And I did not know that High Gain, Ameritron, and Vectronics were sister companies, and they're all shutting the doors. Their last day will be in May of production. They'll sell any surplus they have and continue to do repair work. you know, for the foreseeable, but as far as production, oil production in Med A and oil system companies will cease.
Oh, that's a shame. We all kind of make jokes about MFJ. It was a massive company, and yeah, I was aware that all of these other brands had been bought up by him throughout the last few decades. Where people don't think that Cushcraft or Hygain or Mirage or a bunch of other companies, were just MFJ companies that were bought by Marju. I can understand. The amateur radio market is not a lucrative one. I've spoken to a few guys who are in the actual business, despair that they don't really make that much. It's almost a labor of love. So, that would be a big nut to invest in. You know, his is not a simple, there's been more than a few companies that the owner retired and they sold three or four or maybe five different products. And the guy who was fresh from his retirement from marketing someplace decided to get into the business. But this is a major kind of company. There's a lot of things going on there. So I could understand where it would be very, very difficult to find a buyer for something like that without just kind of breaking it up into teeny tiny little pieces, and it'd probably take them the next 5 years to sell every piece off. So it's a shame, but it's inevitable. It's a consequence of our hobby. A lot of some of the fine stuff that I've bought is made by mom-and-pop companies. I have my LP500 digital station monitor. There's one guy named Larry Phipps who seems to build them, sell them, respond to them, fix them, what have you. PALSTAR is a relatively small company, a couple of Hungarian immigrants, and that's the nature of our hobby. You know, the demise of the owner can kind of destroy a business. My linear amplifier is an expert system. It's made in Italy. They're going strong as far as I know. But the United States distributorship has switched hands at least three times that I know of, where the distributor gets ill, dies, someone else takes the place, retires, someone else takes the place. So this is the nature of our hobby these days, with the exception of things like transceivers, where, you know, it's not their primary profit thing, but, you know, in Japan, there's the big three, a couple of American companies still crank things out. Otherwise, you know, you never know.
Yeah, you know, it's, I don't want to be too nostalgic here, but it was sad for me to hear because, you know, I have an MFJ analyzer, rather. I just like the looks of it, even though some of the reviews weren't that great. But, I had good results with it, and I think MFJ suffered with quality control, and you could get a good bad unit, but I really was a little put why I couldn't find a buyer. After that, like you say, a labor of love like that, even if you gave the company away, a lot of times you build a company just not to see it go away, but... it's a loss because I don't see anybody else on the horizon that's going to fill those shoes. And maybe somebody will pop up, but, you know, I fear not. So, I see you didn't know, so I'm glad I was able to inform you about it, even though it was bad news, and throw it out there. November Jolly.
Hey, C2GS. Well, I'm glad you told us. It's unfortunate. MFJ was kind of a phenomenon. It didn't start out as this mega corporation, relatively speaking, among hams. Among consumer electronics, they're not mega by any measurement. But, I mean, they grew slowly, little by little, as all these other companies, bosses, kind of, cashed in their chips. He was willing to keep it going. That's a big responsibility. You know, I mean, this is not something, you know, if you're going to be selling a couple of bug Morse code keyers, you can kind of do it on the weekend probably, but this is probably a 24/7 career. And young people don't see this as a career, as an industry to get into. So that's why, again, most of the people who pick up bits and pieces are in their 60s or so. And my guess will be that there will be a couple of guys out there who will buy bits and pieces. You know, someone might buy Cushcraft, another guy might buy Hi-Gain, another guy might buy Maritron. And it's not going to be the same MSJ Enterprises, but we may still see those brands out there under different ownership. Only time will tell.
Yeah, I always thought MFJ was overpriced.
When you said you're linear and that made in Italy, would that be an SGE linear? That's what I have. And I was just going to, if you said Italy, it kind of narrows it down. Is that what you have, Roy, an SGE?
Yeah, it goes by all kinds of, it's SGE. It's also Expert, the 1.3K. I got the 1.3K with a tuner. Nowadays, I think they're only selling the 1.5Ks. Because I don't think the company that manufactures the power transistor is making a 1.3 anymore. But, you know, I've heard people who have had problems, knock on wood. I haven't had any problems with mine. It seems almost like a magic trick. It's about the volume of two shoeboxes, and I can plug it in a non-independent 120-volt line. I don't have to hire electricians to run 220-volt single lines into my shack to power it.
Yeah, when I was making my decision, I originally had it to, I think it's the 1.5K I was going to get, but I wound up getting this KFA. I had a conversation with a gentleman at that time, an elderly gentleman, I got his name right now, percentage-wise, that there were less problems. Returns with the KFA. So I went with the 2KFA. I also have had a good experience so far, knock on wood. There's a very excellent message board full of the SVE Linear. I don't know if you're aware of it. You know, I subscribe to it. I get all these emails daily, and they have a lot of guys that are very familiar with these SVE devices. I just keep it there in reserve. It's like an insurance policy. You know, I don't need it, but if I do, I want it to be there. Are you familiar with that message board?
No, I'm not. Usually what happens, if I ever have any questions, I go searching, I discover these forums, I join them, and it goes on and on and on. Thankfully, again, I've never had any reason to look anything up. It's kind of worked the way it's supposed to work. From the get-go, I think I've had it about 8-plus years. It's a little bit weird buying something from Italy if you don't frequently buy stuff from Italy. I had to wait months and months to get mine because they do not, if they are short staffed, don't hire new people because you can't fire anyone apparently there, so you kind of hire them for almost life. So if you are short-staffed, you just deal with being short-staffed. And then I think my waiting period hit August, and the distributor told me August, Italy shuts down for the month. So I wouldn't expect it any time too soon from August. So eventually, after waiting a while, I've had to wait for a lot of my equipment. My LP500 digital station monitor, I think I put my name down and waited for 3 years before its design was finished. They had to redesign because some parts went out of production, and he redesigned it. When he finally got stock, and he had a list from before I put my name on those. So that was the longest I waited for any ham gear, was 3 years. I think the linear amplifier was about 5 months of waiting.
Yeah, that was pretty much my experience, too. That was my memory when I ordered the FA. It went like, okay, well, how do I send the payment, in the mail? All right, it came from Italy. Yeah. And that 2KFA is a monster.
I mean, wow, I don't want to miss water. That thing's got to be 60, 70 pounds. That is a monster. And I think the quality, from what I'm reading, you know, has really gone down. When I bought mine, it might have been one of the best times to buy one of them, because I think it's getting a little better, but that's just...